I'm Mark. I'm Mark Barnsley. I'm a former anarchist prisoner. Some of you I know already. I was released from prison a year ago. It's the first time I've been able to travel out of the UK. I only recently was allowed a passport, so it's my first visit to Europe for a few years. First time I've been in Amsterdam for about 20 years. So I was doing something a little bit different last time I was here. I'd like to thank Amsterdam Anarchist Group for inviting me, and thanks to everybody for coming. So I'm going to speak for a little while, and then if you want to ask questions after that, I'm quite happy to answer them. But if I use a word of slang or something that you don't understand, just, you know, let me know and I'll try and explain what he means. I spent about half my adult life in prison as a result of my political beliefs. That's something I'd rather not have done, but it means that I am rather familiar, at least, with the British prison system. I've been involved in politics, in anarchist politics, just about my whole life. I was politically active even as a child. I grew up in times quite different to today, in the 1960s, when there was a lot of political struggle going on around the world that obviously interests me. You know, Paris 68, and the rise of the armed struggle in Ireland, civil rights movement there, and also in America, the anti-Vietnam War movement. So a lot of stuff happening, and big industrial unrest also in the UK. And I often think it would be difficult to grow up in those times and not be politically interested, but of course many people aren't. That is a bit of an enigma for me, but I've always been politically active, and I've been involved in the anarchist movement since I was about 14. I'm from Sheffield. I'm a working class guy. Sheffield is in the north of England. And when I got involved with Sheffield Anarchists, I was involved in editing a school's anti-fascist paper, in doing lots of anti-fascist stuff, in opposing the war in Ireland. And then when I was, well, just before I was 17, I decided to go to Lebanon. Now, times then were very different to today. You know, many of us believed in armed struggle, and if you became involved in the anarchist movement then, probably very sooner rather than later, you would come into contact with those ideas, and you may choose to actually, you know, take up the gun. I don't know if anybody here, maybe most of you look younger than me, maybe don't know about the Lebanese Civil War. Basically in Lebanon you had a situation where you had a small group of very rich people and a large number of very, very poor people. And throughout the 1970s, people were unhappy about the way that things were there, you know, and there was a growing political influence, particularly from Palestinians, who were refugees in the country. And so in 1975, the fascists decided to bomb a Palestinian refugee camp called Tal al-Zata from the air. This is like the Lebanese Air Force, and that was the start of the Lebanese Civil War. Now, you had in Lebanon a classic fascist party, much the same as the Flange in Spain, they would call the Flange. Pierre Gemayel was Hitler's guest at the 1936 Olympics. So primarily when myself and one other anarchist comrade and another comrade went out to fight in Lebanon, we went to confront the fascists, but also 1978 was the year when the Israelis invaded Lebanon. They were there for another 20 years. So we went out there to show solidarity with our comrades out there, and also to spread our anarchist ideas. Because something I found then and something I found later in prison is, you know, if you can win people's respect, they are far more willing to listen to your politics. And we've certainly had a lot of people that we fought alongside in Lebanon were certainly interested in our anarchist beliefs. As things progressed, I was also involved in armed struggle in other countries. And in 1980, I was arrested on an explosives charge for possession of explosives in England. Interestingly, I was arrested by a special branch detective inspector. Special branch is the British political police. I was arrested by a special branch detective inspector called Detective Inspector Clark. Remember that name because he comes up a little bit later. I was in prison, and the first time I'd been inside, but I didn't think it was a time, you know, when I should stop being politically active. Rather, as I've always viewed it, as an opportunity to continue the struggle, just working in a different environment. And I like to think that, you know, I made myself as big a pain in the arse as I possibly could be. I refused to work all the time I was inside. In fact, I mean, I was so much trouble for them, they actually used to pay me not to go to work. But in the end, but yeah, when I was released from prison, I became involved again in the anarchist movement, and began editing the Sheffield Anarchist, which is a paper that was first published in 1891. And I was actually one of my co-editors at one time is sitting over there, Jane Lethborough, who was also with me at the Pomona incident, which is again something I'll go on to talk about in a minute. I was involved in anti-fascist stuff, some very militant anti-fascist stuff, setting up Sheffield Prisoner Support Group, the miner strike of 1984-1985 in the UK. Basically a lot of political stuff. And Sheffield, you know, it's a big town. It's probably got about the same population as Amsterdam, but you don't really have to do that much to stand out, and certainly the case that the police in Sheffield, you know, really did not like me, and on a number of occasions had tried to fit me up on relatively minor charges. But I was always, you know, harassed. I've been searched in the street numerous times. My house has been searched. I've been beaten up by them. So I would come into contact with the police routinely. And we, you know, we had a very large presence, Sheffield Anarchists, in the town. We, you know, we were a large group. We squatted anarchist centres. You know, we were involved in a lot of stuff. And in 1994, the cops got the opportunity to fit me up and put me behind bars. This is something that they, you know, they've done to other comrades both before, and they've done it since. And something we always need to be aware that these things do happen. Some of you here already know the story. If you want to read the whole thing, there's pamphlets and leaflets over there. But basically what happened was that bright sunny day, much like today, I just got a newborn baby, 6 weeks old. I went out for a walk with Jane sitting over there, and we called for a drink at a pub. And ended up getting attacked by 15 drunken middle-class students. And although, you know, it was them that attacked us, I ended up getting sent to prison for it. Now, even taking into account the travesty of his trial and the convictions, you would normally expect for that kind of thing, you know, with no previous convictions of violence, maybe probation or a very short prison sentence. I mean, in fact, I got a total of 39 years, 12 of which were to run concurrent. So I already at that time, when I received the sentence, I'd been inside about 18 months, 19 months on remand, because a large proportion of British prisoners are actually unconvicted. There's very little use of the bail system, particularly where the cops are opposed to it. In practice, if they oppose bail, you won't get it. So, I mean, the if you read a little bit of the case, you quickly see that the trial is an absolute joke. You know, even some of the it's not as if there weren't any witnesses to the incident. In fact, there were plenty of witnesses who supported my version of events, but all that was swept under the carpet. And I don't allege that the cop, you know, it's a case of mistaken identity. What I'm saying is that the cops deliberately fitted me up. And interestingly, I referred a few minutes ago to this guy, Detective Inspector Clark, who arrested me in Dover in 1980, which is on the south coast. Dover is on the south coast of England. In 1994, when I was arrested in Sheffield, he just happened to be in charge of the police station that dealt with prosecution. The same police station that I'd actually brought proceedings against for wrongful arrest and malicious prosecution a couple of years earlier after a previous attempt to fit me up. So So there's certainly no love lost between me and the British state. And they took me out of circulation in the way that they'd done with other people. Stuart Christie, some of you may have heard of, he was the, with Albert Meltzer, founder of the Modern Anarchist Black Cross. He also had the same harassment, spent years unconvicted in prisons with the cops trying to fit him up. Fortunately, he didn't spend as long in prison as I did, but you know, obviously had a big effect in terms of his life and in terms of him out of circulation, taking him out of the movement. So there I was, in prison. I've just got 12 years. I know I've been fitted up. I'm in touch with a few individual comrades, but obviously a campaign was needed in terms of challenging my conviction. Both a legal campaign, like, you know, to challenge the case through the courts, and also campaign to put pressure on those courts, because you know, there have been, for many years, you know, for since Simon Memorial, miscarriage of justice after miscarriage of justice in the UK. There are many, many working class people are fitted up every year in England. And some of those cases have been successfully overturned. If people might have heard of the Birmingham 6 case, the Guildford 4 case, you may have seen the film about the latter. But the common denominator of all of those cases is that they were supported by a large campaign to put pressure on the state, because if you don't have that campaign, irrespective of how good your legal case is, they will sweep the matter under the carpet. The Birmingham 6 had to go to the appeal court several times before the case was successfully overturned, even though it was obvious to anybody with any intelligence that the case stank. So my campaign got off the ground in about 1996, and it took a few years to get it really building, primarily because the prison support group, the anarchist prison support groups in Britain at that time were so weak. The natural constituency that I should have been able to rely upon just wasn't there. There was an anarchist Black Cross network in Britain at that time, but to all intents and purposes, it was completely useless. Not just as far as I was concerned, but as far as anybody was concerned, it was just basically a small number of people squabbling amongst each other, falling out, doing nothing apart from printing some irrelevant propaganda and basically stealing money that they were raising for prisoners. And, you know, fortunately, I can go into details about this, fortunately that network is now gone. And there is, you know, there is only one ABC group in England now, that's ABC Brighton, who were nothing to do with this. They were formed afterwards in a very effective prison support group. But I think that raises an issue there of accountability and responsibility with our movement, and something, you know, that you know, anybody can really set up a prison support group, but we do need to be accountable, and we need, you know, certainly it's the case in England. This has happened time and time again. I can remember going back to 1980 when somebody set up a prisoner's book scheme and stole the money from it. People know who these, you know, other comrades know who these people are, and they should be challenged about it. And when you know, you know, when you get involved in prison support, it has to be seen as a long-term commitment. And just going back to my campaign, I think there's a lot to learn from what happened to me. It's a slightly different situation here in mainland Europe, because generally prisoner solidarity is considered far more seriously. But I think there are things that can be learned from what happened with me. Both negative things, in terms of, you know, I basically spent 5 years in prison before I was getting a great deal of support at all, you know. But also some very positive things, because in many ways it was a very good campaign in the final few years of my imprisonment, and it did provide me with a lot of support. And a lot of actions and initiatives were launched which aren't common to the UK. And some of them, like, say, for example, noise demos, I know were imported directly from Holland, you know, that people came over here and they saw that tactic. Thought this is an effective thing that we can use, and that was used effectively for me. But targeting, you know, the Home Secretary, targeting the prisons minister, you know, actually, because these people, you know, they've got names and addresses, they speak at their constituencies regularly, going down there and really giving them a hard time, not letting them get away with it. Now, I was released from prison last year, and when my campaign was just going, one of my concerns throughout the rest of my imprisonment was something that I read about this case, which haunted me, and it's a case that you won't know about. It was called the Luton Post Office Murders. And basically, it happened in the 1960s in England, and these two guys were fitted up for an armed robbery where somebody was killed. Blatantly, it was a case of police corruption. The police, the real murderer was protected by the police because he was paying them, and they sent two innocent people to prison. Very blatantly. And in fact, these two guys, they're dead years ago, were cleared just a few weeks ago by the appeal court. So, you know, a great deal of use that is to them. You know, they were cleared posthumously. What happened was that they had a really large campaign, and this eventually led to their release. But while they were released, they were still considered guilty. They hadn't been cleared by the courts. And what happened was that when they were released, their campaign just evaporated because people thought, well, they're out of prison now. What they're moaning about? And it drove them both mad. You know, they're not completely to insanity, but they died very early. They died frustrated, and they died still unvindicated. And of course, you know, for me as an anarchist, I know that in many ways, you know, the concept of bourgeois justice is an entirely liberal one. That really, you know, the only justice that we will ever get is the justice we claim for ourselves, the justice we take for ourselves. But that's not to say that I think that we should just allow the state to get away with things in this situation. Because I'm still very subject to real police harassment. And that is something that will affect me until my miscarriage of justice is overturned. Because I've only just been able to leave the country, have the police questioning me, asking questions about me. Just a few weeks ago, I could be sent back to prison without even committing any crime. And if I'm arrested on a demonstration, for example, for, you know, punching a policeman's fist with my head, I can go to prison for life. Now, that isn't going to cow me. That isn't going to stop me being a political activist. Not at all. Activism is my act of vengeance. I'm determined to every day of my life is spent fighting the state, being politically active. I'm not going to let them intimidate me. But in terms of my campaign, it's certainly the case within the UK that while there are still good people involved, the support has in many ways dissipated because people think, well, he's out of prison now. And that, for me, you know, for me personally, and I think for the movements in the UK, should be a shame. Because the message, you know, when one of our comrades is imprisoned, that we should be sending to the state is we won't, as a movement, tolerate that. Not we'll allow them to get away with it. While I was inside, you know, my campaign obviously was able to help me a lot in terms of solidarity. Because I had a hard time inside. I didn't have an easy time at all. I was, for example, moved 22 times. There's a practice that British prisoners call ghosting, where you're just taken, you're in your cell one night, the screws come and get you, you're usually beaten up, you're taken to the segregation unit, and that's it, you don't know where you're going. In the year 2000 alone, I was moved from Full Sutton Prison near York, which is in the middle of England, down to the southwest, then into Wales, then back into the centre of England, then over to the Isle of Wight, then back to a place called Milton Keynes, which is sort of, you know, in the south, then up to Yorkshire, and then up to Durham. That was in 1 year alone. So, you know, constantly while I was inside, the screws, you know, the prison system tried to break me. And that is done for very real reasons. It's not just an act of spite. It's to send a message, you know, to the prisoners. Because from the day that I was arrested, I was involved in prison politics. The first prison I was in was well, the first prison I was in for any length of time was Doncaster Prison, which was a newly opened private prison in South Yorkshire. And it's run by an American company, Wackenhut, a notorious American company, been involved much the same way as, say, the Pinkerton Detective Agency in strike breaking, and they have prisons in America and Australia. And they're probably still going to have prisons over here, you know, because these same companies we're seeing spread right across the world. When I was first in there, you know, I was elected by the other prisoners as a prisoner spokesperson. And I had a very strong mandate, because the thing is, this prison had been opened prematurely with not enough staff. And we took full advantage of that in terms of demanding better conditions. And, I mean, as the prisoner's spokesperson, I had probably more power in them than the governor did, because he was frightened to come out of his office. He'd just hide in there. And so, you know, if we didn't like the food, we would send it back. If we didn't want to go in our cells, we wouldn't go in them. Basically, it was an experience in seeing what happens when prisoners stick together. You know, they can really have an effect in terms of their own conditions. They might not be able to get out, but they can certainly influence things to a very real extent. My activism continued when I was moved from that prison. And when I was at Full Sutton Prison in York in 1997, there was a full-scale riot, and we created £2.5 million of damage, I'm very pleased to say. You know, the prison was effectively destroyed. So 2 years later, a number of people, mainly at random, were charged with the prison riot. And then I was the main defence witness. So they were all found not guilty because of my evidence. And this very, very expensive trial meant that, and the wrecking of the prison itself basically had no results for the state. Nobody was sent to prison for it. So after that, there was a very real escalation in the way that I was treated by the state. And that is done deliberately so that prisoners will look at that and say, you know, in a future situation where they may be asked to help a comrade, I don't know about that, because I saw what happened to that Mark Barnsley. You know, he gave evidence for those guys, and the next 2 years he spent in solitary confinement. So it's important for me, as a political prisoner, to be able to refute that, so to turn it around, so that a few people might say that, but then somebody else maybe will say, yeah, but he was still fucking fighting them. Because everywhere I went, all these prisons I got sent to, I found that I had support. And really, the state couldn't isolate me. And they lost in the end, in one sense, because they couldn't find a prison that would take me. You know, I just get parked up somewhere, and I've had access to my prison file since then, under the British States Protection Act. And I've seen all these letters. You know, you think you were trying to get into a private gentleman's club or something, you know, because they don't want me in their prison. I mean, that's how you want it. You don't want to go to a prison and them say, yeah, come back anytime. You know, anytime you want to come in, just we'll let you in. You know, you know, as political prisoners, we should be leaving those fucking places with them going, God, I don't want that bastard back again. You know, so I would cause as much trouble as I can for the British state, because they, you know, they fucking lock me up, you know. I'm not going to make it easy for them. I was inside during what was quite an interesting period during the British struggle, though the interest in many ways is negative, because it's a period when really the state recaptured a lot of ground. And basically, from about 1969 onwards, British prisoners organised for better conditions. British prisons are very austere, you know, they really are. They're very old-fashioned, very basic. You know, many of them just have stone floors. You know, solitary confinement is used a lot. You know, prisoners are entitled to only half an hour in the open air only in a cage. That's called exercise. You get half an hour of that a day. Even in Victorian times, you got an hour. The food is poor, you know, the conditions are bad, the healthcare is almost non-existent. So, you know, British prisons are very austere, and in many ways they're getting worse. But throughout the 70s and 1980s, British prisoners fought really hard for better conditions. And, you know, many of the people involved in that were Irish Republican prisoners, because that was a solid block of prisoners there. And also Angry Brigade prisoners, of which there were only a few, but they were, you know, they're certainly political prisoners. And they achieved a degree of liberalisation, particularly in the maximum security prisons in which I was always held. So prisoners had more autonomy, if only because the screws were frightened to confront them because of fear of violence. In 1991, there was a big uprising in a local prison, which is basically a local prison is like a prison for mainly for unconvicted prisoners, but it's the local prison in the town. It's not a high security prison. Though it may hold some high security prisoners, but only for short periods, and they'll be usually be held in the segregation unit. So Strangeways was such a prison, and then that's in Manchester. In 1991, there was a big uprising there, and prisoners basically took over the prison and ended up with a rooftop protest where they were, you know, in the full view of the world's media for considerable period of time. And that was a real embarrassment for the British state and for the British prison service. And so at that time, while there was much talk about liberalising the prisons again, of introducing things like putting toilets in the cells, which British prisoners didn't have then. And in some British prisons, they still don't have toilets in the cells. Of allowing people out their cells a bit more. And, you know, generally sort of making things a little bit more relaxed. But really, that was only a tactical withdrawal by the state, because they put in place at the same time new security measures. When they built new prisons, they were built differently. They had lower roofs so that if there's a protest, you can't see it from outside. They may start making use of more CCTV cameras. The screws had more riot training. And also they developed a number of like psychological tactics which they would use to great effect. I came into prison in 1994, and shortly after I was imprisoned there was an escape by mainly by IRA prisoners from Whitemoor prison in Cambridgeshire. And these men were supposed to be among the most closely guarded in the country. But while they were climbing over the wall, the guards that were supposed to be looking after them or maintaining their security were actually reading books and playing Scrabble. So there was a big public inquiry about this, a big stink about this. And then just a few months later, Parker's prison, another high security prison on the Isle of Wight, three prisoners just walked out of there. With a key. What they'd actually done is that one of the governors there had this habit of pointing his key at people when he was talking to them, and they just looked at the key and copied it, and just escaped. So these two events really signalled something pretty major in the prison system, and two reports were commissioned, known as the Whitemoor Report and the Learmonth Report, and they were basically the Woodcock Report and the Learmonth Report. Woodcock was previously Britain's highest-ranking cop, and Learmonth was just some old idiot that they found, you know. So basically, they were very stacked reports. They knew that these reports weren't going to do any prisoners any favours for prisoners. These reports came up with a number of recommendations which have led to a wave of repression in the prison system over the last 7 or 8 years. So prisoners were stripped of their property, more use was made of segregation units. But the most interesting idea was an idea that they tried to introduce in the past, but which prisoners at that time were too militant to accept, and it's called the Incentives and Earned Privileges Scheme. And how this works basically is that prisoners are split into a state-defined class system, where you have at the bottom level basic prisoners, then standard prisoners, and then enhanced prisoners. And those levels, which are determined by the screws, decide whether how many visits they have each month, what jobs they have, how much time they spend in their cell. So basically all of their conditions are decided by these things. And whereas in the 1980s, when they tried to introduce that system, which was known then as the staging system, prisoners rejected it and just wouldn't tolerate it. It has been successful as far as the state's concerned, and has made a real setback in terms of the prison struggle generally, and the prison struggle. So, really, in terms of the struggle within British prisons, political prisoners are looking at building things from scratch. The thing is, in the 70s and 80s, prisoners were very rebellious, very militant. But it's easy to be a rebel when everybody's a rebel. Now there are only a few rebels. It's a lot harder. I think that shows... the difference between a rebel and a revolutionary, that we need to sort of foster genuine political consciousness in prisoners. And it also showed for me, somebody who, when I was involved in setting up Sheffield Prisoner Support Group, our slogan was basically all prisoners are political prisoners. But I think that is only true to some extent, that's true on one level, but there is a real difference between some prisoners, between political prisoners, and people who are in for selling drugs or committing burglaries. And while there may be the possibility of politicising them, as far as I'm concerned, we should be providing maximum support to our own political prisoners. And providing political support to all prisoners in struggle. That would be my slogan. Because I think, we, as political activists, it's now more likely than ever that we will go to prison. The state is locking up more of us than ever. That's happening, that's happening across the world. And, we really need to look... seriously at prisoner solidarity. It should be a priority for us as anarchists, if only as a form of insurance, because if we go to prison, who's going to look after us? I think that one of the areas that the British ABC went wrong, for example, is that in the 1980s they had a situation where they basically didn't have any anarchist prisoners in England. And so they were just supporting people that they seemed to get a hold of basically by, just like randomly. They were completely marginalised from the prison struggle and didn't know what to do. And, I mean, when I was in prison and I came across their list of prisoners, I was absolutely horrified because, they got rapists on that list. They've got police informers on that list. And they've just got a selection of some of the people. There's a few genuine decent guys on there, but also a lot of scumbags and people who had really taken them for a ride. And there was this particular guy that the British ABC used to trumpet called Kenny Carter. And the thing is, this discredited them in the eyes of prisoners throughout the prison system, because everybody knows this guy, and he's regarded as the biggest liar in the prison system, He's in for killing another prisoner. That's what he's doing time for. And they were pushing him as some sort of political prisoner. It's quite amusing, but, it cost the ABC a lot of money. One of the things that he did is he told them that the screws had beat him up so badly... that he had to have a private operation to save his knee. Well, you can't have a private operation in a British prison. It's not possible. But the ABC didn't know that. So they organised this campaign to save Kenny's knee. And, he just paid for his heroin. It didn't happen at all. But, some of the people they were supporting were... Kenny Carter's unlikely to get out of prison. Some of the people they were supporting were really genuinely dangerous, and they shouldn't have been circulating that information without checking people out first. For me, I think one of the things we should be doing, as well as supporting our own political prisoners, is confronting the prison state. Because then we don't have to pick and choose about prison. We don't have to say, we don't have to have this conversation about, should we support this guy or not, but what about this thing he did then? In terms of confronting the prison state, that's far more important, because that affects all prisoners, you know, fighting for better prison conditions and ultimately for the abolition of prison. Because that's, you know, it's something I was talking to somebody about a few minutes ago. And I think that's something that, unfortunately, a lot of anarchists backtrack on. You know, that me as an anarchist, I am for the abolition of prisons, the abolition of all prisons and the freeing of all prisoners. And that's not just because I'm an anarchist, that's because I've been in prison and I've seen how rotten the system is. Because, you know, prison doesn't work on any level at all. It's like, you know, if you build more motorways, you end up with more cars. And, you know, as anarchists, we're often presented with these monolithic ideas like, well, we need money because we've always had money, and we need government because we've always had government, and we need prisons because we've always had them. That isn't true at all. You know, the prison state is a very recent concept in terms of our history. You know, for thousands of years, we dealt with, you know, antisocial crime very differently. And we, you know, we need to look at this because, you know, in an anarchist society, it's not just, you know, who's going to be in prison, it's who's going to put them there. I'm not going to turn the key. So, you know, it's not an area we should be looking at. I mean, the whole idea for me is just ridiculous. The idea that you take somebody who has done something, has transgressed against society, and you stick them in a prison with some other people who've done the same, and they're supposed to come out there better. It just seems ludicrous to me, you know. I don't think prison works to any extent, and it doesn't provide people with any form of protection either, you know. Even when we look at the most antisocial crimes, it doesn't make people better. It makes good people bad and bad people worse. So, you know, I mean, as anarchists, I really think we need to think about this, and it's something we, you know, we shouldn't backpedal on. Like, you know, I'm you know, certainly, you know, a prison abolitionist. I talked about the need for prison solidarity, and I'm somebody who, certainly in my writings, has, you know, in the past been extremely critical of the anarchist movement for not being able to provide enough solidarity for our prisoners. That's certainly the case in the UK. I have to say, I always got far more support from Europe, you know, than certainly initially, than I did, you know, from my own hometown, which is a bit sad. But while we as anarchists have a responsibility to support our prisoners, I think that when we go to prison, we also have a responsibility to work, to behave as anarchists. Because we're not there as individuals, we're there as part of a movement. And, you know, people sometimes say to me, well, it's up to individuals to decide how they do the time. To some extent, that's true. You know, I mean, you know, I don't expect anybody to go around headbutting tanks. But, you know, we need to maintain our integrity. And particularly, you know, when we go to prison for political acts, nobody will take our politics seriously if we're not personally worthy of credibility. You know, so we need to behave as anarchists in terms of, you know, how we deal with the state, how we deal with the guards, how we deal with other prisoners. Because, you know, we can have read all the Alexander Berkman in the world. But if we're informing on other prisoners, then we're not anarchists. You know, we're grassers. That's what we are. You know, we're just informers. And nobody will take us seriously, and we don't deserve any support if we behave like that. You know, we don't deserve any support from the movement. But in terms of maintaining our integrity, you know, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes it's about little things, you know. I can remember once, you know, being in a situation where I was forced onto, the screws tried to force me into prison uniform, and I wasn't wearing it. I wasn't going to wear it. And so first they tried to intimidate me with violence and whatnot, and that didn't work. And then they sort of tried the soft cop bit, you know, and they said to me, I was in the segregation unit, there was nobody else there. And they said, well, nobody's going to know you're going to put it on anyway, you know. But the thing is, I'd have known I'd put it on, you know, and they'd have known. And that's all that matters, you know, because they're not going to fucking see me do that, you know. So, you know, integrity sometimes comes down to very, very small things, but it's very important that you don't surrender that. Not just in terms of your politics, but in terms of surviving prison. You know, like the Dutch have done a lot of research into the effects of long-term imprisonment, and they know that after 5 years of continuous imprisonment, you know, the psychological effects are irreparable. You will never be the same again. That's irrespective of how you behave. And if you look at... you know, there are a number of former British prisoners, people like Paddy Hill of the Birmingham Six, who've had brain scans, and you can see the damage to their brains. You know, you can see holes in it, like the damage you might get to a boxer's brain. long-term imprisonment has certainly affected me. You know, it certainly affected me physically, you know. But psychologists know that the biggest psychological damage that imprisonment will cause you is disempowerment. Disempowerment, it's when you... we say, you know, if you empower yourself, you become stronger. You take control. You take control of your own life. You know, you act for yourself. So to disempower is the very opposite of that. To lose control of your own life, to surrender something about yourself, not to have it taken from you, but to surrender it. There's two very different things there. You know, the basically, when you're in prison, the screws can do anything to you. They can beat you up. They can take your clothes. They can shit in your food. Whatever. But that is a different thing to surrendering to them, you know, to walk in the line, you know. In some segregation units in Britain, they used to have a thing where you came out of your cell and there would be a line, just a painted line, and they're serving the food there opposite your cell, but you're supposed to walk all the way around. And the screws say to you, if you cross the line, we will beat you up. But I'm not walking the fucking line, you know. They can beat me up, I'm not fucking walking the line. So, you know, psychologists know that the most damaging effects of imprisonment is disempowerment. But if you refuse to surrender your integrity, you are never completely disempowered. You're not surrendering. So in many ways, you know, despite the fact that if you're a political prisoner, you will spend longer in solitary confinement, that you may be brutalized, you are also helping to protect yourself psychologically. So, you know, it's an important thing. Now, you know, I got out of prison last year. You know, things haven't been easy for me. I was homeless for a while. I was living out of a rucksack. I've had lots of hassle from the cops. That's still happening to me. I'm still here. And as I say, you know, doing this kind of thing, you know, fighting the state every day, you know, that is my act of revenge, and it's something I'll continue to do for the rest of my life.